and sound good.
Yeah, we'll see.
Confidence like that, I mean.
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I'm Austin Rude, and I'm the son.
And I'm Phil Rude, I'm the dad. Each week, we watch a movie, and then we get on mic and talk about it. And this week, we're continuing to walk through sci-fi horror.
Spooky times.
It's Halloween season, so yeah, we're getting into it. And, yeah, we got a good one this week.
Oh, I'm super excited for it.
This was your pick.
Yeah.
So, why don't you introduce us to your movie?
Well, you know, last week we watched a movie in which a mad scientist is driven by ambition to complete his life's work, only for that invention to turn on him and end in disaster.
Also, only for him to lose interest in it halfway through the movie. His life's work and obsession. Okay. Yes.
But this week, we also watched a movie about a mad scientist driven by ambition to complete his life's work, only for his invention to turn on him and end in disaster. That is, of course, The Fly. The Fly was made in 1986, and it follows the scientist Seth Brundle as he attempts to create a teleportation device. Using this machine on himself, he accidentally merges his DNA with the fly and begins a wicked transformation as he slowly becomes something new and dangerous. The Fly stars Jeff Goldblum, see?
What was that?
I was trying to do... Is that not Jeff Goldblum? It wasn't very good.
Yeah, I think you would do a better Gina Davis impression.
I don't even know how to... Let's cut that
out. That's my whole point. Oh no, that is staying in.
Oh god, maybe if I was wearing like a gold robe I'd be able to impersonate him better.
It's the very essence of Jeff Goldblum is you don't get it, you don't understand what it is. It's a whole state of what was I saying? I don't know. Moving on. That's also a terrible Jeff Goldblum impression.
That was much better than mine,
now,
though.
Now we both have a bad impression in the... Okay.
Fair enough.
We could do this the entire episode, but I don't think we need to.
It is fun to impersonate Jeff Goldblum. Anyway, this movie stars him as well as Gina Davis and John Getz? Sure. It also includes a cameo from the director himself, David Cronenberg. The movie was written by Charles Edward Pogue and David Cronenberg, and it is based off the 1958 movie of the same name.
First off, who is David Cronenberg playing? What's his cameo?
He plays the gynecologist.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
It's fun, right?
Yeah. That is fun. And also, you didn't mention it, but I'll say little known fact, but I think a lot of people closer to my age know this because we have a little more connection to him. Mel Brooks is a big producer on this film.
I didn't know that.
Comedy legend Mel Brooks produced The Fly, yes.
And you can tell by all the laughs that
that's what's such a weird thing, but like, I mean, the more you get into paying attention to producers, the more you understand, like, oh, this is a business for people with money in Hollywood. Like, they just produce things and they back things, and a lot of them own production companies, and what they produce is not necessarily the same thing that they create themselves, you know, like,
right, it can be, but in a very different genre.
But I do when it came, his production company came up at the beginning of this, it's like Brooks Film or something like that, and I was like, oh, is this James L. Brooks? Oh, and then I'm like, oh no, it's Mel Brooks. It's it's just so weird because it's so not hilarious the way a Mel Brooks movie is.
Yeah, but, that's interesting though.
Yeah.
I don't know where to start with this movie.
I will start with, because we're on Cats, I just want to, before we get away from that, I want to say, every time I watch a movie with Gina Davis in it, I am reminded how great Gina Davis is. I think she's awesome. I think everything she did in this period, you know, Beetlejuice, Thelma and Louise, this was right before she got into doing action movies like The Long Kiss Goodnight. I'm going to forget about that weird pirate movie she made. Gina Davis, A League of Their Own. Gina Davis was like unstoppable at this point. And she's great. And I think she's one of those actors who's kind of just gotten better with age. She was on Glow, on the last season of Glow. And she was just wonderful on that. I saw some things. She has a new book coming out that's some sort of memoir, tell-all kind of thing.
That's cool.
That's shedding some light on, you know, her bad relationship with Bill Murray and working relationship. They were never together. But yeah, I love Gina Davis. I think she's great, and I think she's great in this movie.
She was Lydia in
what is her name? She's the dead wife. She's Alec Baldwin's wife.
Oh, okay.
Who
Gonna say I don't recognize her from Beetlejuice. So.
Yeah, it's not Winona Ryder is Lydia and I want to say Susan, but I don't think that's right in Beetlejuice. I'm sorry. I'm somewhere checked out. But yeah, I maintain that Thelma and Louise is one of Ridley Scott's greatest movies. And her and Susan Sarandon are a big part of that. Thelma and Louise is a great movie. It really is.
Haven't seen it.
You really should.
Know nothing
I think you would really, really like it.
Isn't that a band?
No, it's these two women who go on a road trip and end up having a big adventure and running from the law, and it's really, really great.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you would really enjoy it.
That sounds like a fun movie. I've just never.
Maybe we'll do it on the show, because I think you would enjoy it, and I think we'd have a good conversation about it.
Probably.
But yeah. Gina Davis, she's great.
She's great in this, too.
She's awesome in this, yeah.
I love her character, and I don't even know if it's so much as how she's written as just the way it's acted.
I think it's both. I think they wrote a fully formed character, a person.
Right.
She's not just a girlfriend. Well, and I think she is able to perform because she's given so much to do.
Right. I mean, that's why first off, in case you didn't get it, I like this movie. This is a great movie. And I think it works where a lot of horror movies don't work because it spends so much time like developing the characters. Like
sure.
The first 30 minutes of this, there's no horror really going on. It's just like,
there's a vibe, but yeah.
There is, but it's just getting to know these characters and their relationship.
And them becoming America's tallest couple.
Like, that's right.
Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis, both very tall. I found that a little weird because Hollywood likes short people, but I'm like, they really cast some tall people in this.
Well, that's why they have to live in a warehouse.
In a loft with the high ceilings.
They can't find a home yes. that'll fit them.
They need the big industrial doors and everything on
there.
That's
it. Yeah,
that's a really solid point. And why Seth Brundle hates cars. He can't fit in them.
Of course.
That's why he has to invent teleporting.
I did love that detail that he hates teleportation and
his whole transportation. Motivation for teleporting things is so that he won't be carsick anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense.
I think it's very, very silly, but it still works, and it's a good indicator of how much attention to detail they paid in, like, making these characters and trying to make them feel real.
Right, just adding in little bits like that.
Yeah. Anyway, back to your thought about the character development. Now, this movie starts with... this movie's only like an hour and a half long.
Is it really?
And you're right. Like the first almost third of that is just getting to know these characters. We see Gina Davis and her home life with her ex-boyfriend slash boss.
Super weird, by the way.
Very weird. Very awkward. Very gross.
But, I mean, most of this movie, like, isn't even a horror movie. Like, it's a slow build, I guess is what it is. But, like, there's not a lot going on for a lot of it. Which is good. Like, I don't begrudge it for that.
It's slightly quiet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the horror is in, like, the gross-out stuff.
Right, like the baboon being turned inside out.
That was pretty sweet.
It was like, pretty awesome.
It really was cool. But gross, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, later on, the more transformation that he goes through, the arm wrestling contest where he breaks that guy's... but, like, yeah, there's a lot of, like, shock value kind of stuff, but... you're right. This is all... I think the heart of this is a character-based story. And I think that is why this movie works. A lot of people are going to be turned off by the body horror of this. It's a freaking Cronenberg movie. Or the gross-out stuff. It's going to be too disgusting for some people. But I think for people who aren't bothered by that stuff and appreciate, like, good characters... this movie really clicks, and I've seen it a couple times, and it's one of the, I think this time I realized, like, oh, this is one of those movies where, like, I forget how good it is until I watch it again.
Yeah.
And then I go, oh, this is one of the great, like, sci-fi horror movies of all time, probably, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know how big that canon is, top 50 or, but like this movie is just a really well-made movie. You know what I mean?
It makes you scared because you care about the characters.
Yeah. Yeah, you do care about them. And I think it's a really smart... not everything. There's some stuff I have hang-ups with. But, like, the whole thing is constructed in a really smart way to where the character arcs of this movie are really interesting. Like... mm-hmm. The good guy becomes the bad guy that you feel sorry for, and the bad guy becomes the hero, even though you know he's still a creep.
Right.
Like, there's a real, like, shades of gray thing happening in there that you don't see it done that often anymore. You see a lot of people where it's like, well, our hero has to be uncompromised and you know, infallible, and our villain just has to be a despicable piece of shit, and that's it. But here, I mean, it really is like a tragic story because you still feel sympathy for Seth Brundle, and you're glad that the boss, I can't remember his name.
Not important.
But you're glad that he saves the day, even though you know he's really a piece of shit.
He's like the worst scumbag.
He is like the worst scumbag, but it is like, no, he's not the worst scumbag. He's a man who doesn't know boundaries. And it's one of those things where I think the best case scenario in talking about stuff like that is like, maybe this guy is growing as a person. Maybe there's some redemption for, you know, like, right. Anybody is redeemable in the big picture. And I think, and anybody is fallible. And I think this movie is sort of exploring, like, that idea in having those characters sort of, not completely switch places, but you know what I mean? Switch roles.
I don't know. I see it as, like, he's the hero in that scenario, mm-hmm. just because he was there at the right time. But I don't think he's redeemed.
No. I'm not saying a full redemption. I'm just saying, like, sometimes bad people do good things. Sometimes
right.
good people do bad things. Sometimes people bad people who do a good thing. It's I'm not trying to plot out this guy's entire life after this movie, mm-hmm. which we could see in The Fly 2.
The Fly 2, that's right.
But it is, you know, it's just one of those things that I think is, I bring it up a lot. I think the big draw of Game of Thrones for me was that that's what every character was. Every character was either a tarnished hero or a villain who was very humanized and occasionally did heroic things, even though, or did villainous things for heroic reasons.
Right.
And there was just a lot of people doing a lot of shitty things and a lot of people doing a lot of good things on both sides of that. And that's what made those, whatever the plot line of that show did or didn't do, that was, people watched it because they were drawn into characters because they felt real.
That's where it gets interesting.
Yes. And I think for this movie to do that and be like, hey, we're going to make this genre movie. We're going to make the science fiction horror movie that's a remake of a kind of obscure Vincent Price movie from the 50s. But we're going to write this in a really smart way and have these characters feel like real people. We're talking about a giant insect man. And we're going to make you feel bad for him.
It's the cheesiest plot ever.
Right.
And they made it real.
It's the same thing like Del Toro did with The Shape of Water. He took the creature from the Black Lagoon and he made it a romance.
A sweet love
that
story.
That you really cared about, this fish man and this deaf woman, or this mute woman. Was she deaf? Was she mute?
No, she could hear, but she was mute, though.
I couldn't remember. And the plot of Splash, basically, and make this really sweet movie full of heart and characters that you love and hate. Right. And I think this did the same thing. And I think Del Toro kind of takes a page out of, if you just look at his body of work, it's all science fiction and fantasy that... It doesn't always work for me. There's a couple Del Toro movies I don't really care for. But by and large, he elevates what that genre usually is. And sort of
it's
takes
all
it kind to of
like
next
this
level.
Movie.
Yes. And I think The Fly, it sounds so silly to say because this movie is, you know, I don't even know that this movie was a huge success in the 80s. Like, people saw it, but it wasn't like... It didn't break through or redefine horror. It wasn't
like... It's not
like
culture defining.
It wasn't... It didn't do like what the slasher movies were doing. You know what I mean? But like, this movie's really, really good.
Right. And I love how creepy it is. Because throughout the... Like, you never know where you stand with the characters. Like...
Right.
Because at the start, the Brendel and... I don't know.
Victoria,
right.
Ronnie, they call her. Yeah.
So they meet, and he takes her back.
At a science party.
That's right.
You know.
The science fair at the
science,
high school.
At the local science fair, yep.
Yeah, all the time. You don't know about those?
Where he was talking about how he was going to revolutionize the world, but he couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah, he can't tell anyone about his invention.
He went to a place to tell everybody that he was doing something important.
That's where he picks up girls.
Clearly.
But it worked, and he brought her to this really creepy warehouse, and the whole time you're like...
I think you mean cool apartment?
Sure, Dad. what's it on? Zillow? What's the price range on that?
Well, before or after this incident, because the property value really dropped.
That's true.
After this happened.
I don't know, like, you just never know, like, is he gonna murder her? Is he a nice guy? I couldn't tell, and it helps that he's really weird because he's Jeff Goldblum being Jeff Goldblum.
Now, I think it's important to point out to people who don't have the context, this is before Jeff Goldblum was a meme, you know?
Right, that's in his
Jeff Goldblum
life.
Is just doing, like, this meta, oh, look at me, I'm Jeff Goldblum thing now. But I'm going to say Jeff Goldblum was not even that big of a star at this time. Like,
Was this after Jurassic
Park? No, this is pre-Jurassic Park, and I think this is where a lot of the Jurassic Park character comes from.
That's so weird to me, though, because I see more of who he currently is in this role than in Jurassic Park. In Jurassic Park, he's like, I don't know, some anti-hero or like action star.
He's like the bad boy of math. You know, like, and there's a point in here where I think the core of that character is born at a certain point in the evolution of Brundle or Brundlefly.
Brundlefly.
You know, when he's like talking about how he's like the next evolution of humanity and he's like slamming his fist on the table.
Yeah.
Like that is Ian Malcolm in the before you think about whether or not you or you were so excited about it, you could do it, you didn't think about whether you should do it, and he starts slamming the table, you slapped it on a lunchbox, and I'm like, that there's just this glimpse of like, oh, that's Ian Malcolm, that's where it comes from, like this performance.
But that's cool to me.
He had been in things like, he had been in Silverado. He was in like a TV show in the 70s. Mm-hmm. People like kind of knew who Jeff Goldblum was, but he's nothing like compared to like who he is now.
I know he's changed very much now. Honestly, at times I think he's a little lazy now. Like when he does weird TV shows for Disney Plus or whatever.
That's what I'm saying. He's just doing, it's like, what did I just watch? I watched King of New York.
Right.
This movie from, I think it's 90 or 91. Christopher Walken is a gangster. And it's one of those things that it's good to go and watch stuff like that because it reminds you like, oh, Christopher Walken wasn't always just a meme and a joke. He was at one time like a really great actor. And people would hire him to just leave it open. People would hire him to be in their movie because they wanted a really solid and specific performance. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, we'll hire Christopher Walken because he'll come do that thing and it'll be hilarious. And everyone will go, look, it's Christopher Walken. Like, that's what Jeff Goldblum has become now. Mm-hmm. That's what, like, to some extent, Nicolas Cage has become, is this kind of walking meme that doesn't really get to be an actor anymore.
Yeah, it's like being typecast, but everyone thinks
typecast as a version of yourself. Person. Yes,
but with Jeff Goldblum, like I like somewhere in the middle where he is playing these weird characters, and I feel that more here, like in the antisocial.
Yeah, he's a weirdo.
Yeah, that is what I like of here.
And sure.
That's why this feels closer to modern Jeff Goldblum than, like, his character in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Who seems cooler than this character.
Right. Well, yeah, the guy in Jurassic Park is, he's kind of like a, he's really trying to be cool. Like, he's that guy who's, like, really trying. Who won't be wowed by dinosaurs. You know what I mean?
Oh, dinosaurs? Pfft, I saw three of those last
week. Oh, yeah, you shouldn't do that, John. And but then, like, yeah. No, he is that weirdo. He's always been that weirdo. And I think that did help him get parts like this, where you want someone who's kind of a nerd. I mean,
right.
He looks like this tall, awkward nerd, but also it's like he brings a girl back and he has a piano. He's like, oh, check it out. I play jazz piano. And and it's like, yeah, that's kind of just regular Jeff Goldblum, too. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of cool, but in a real nerdy way.
We need a nerd, but we also need him to have a six pack for the 500 sex scenes we're going
to
put
also, in. And we also need him to not be like, you don't want him to be the Revenge of the Nerds. You don't want him to be like, oh, the pocket protector and things like right. that.
He's not an obnoxious.
He's a regular weirdo. Guy. Yeah. He's just kind of socially awkward.
Yeah, he's got some quirks.
And I think Goldblum fits that role really well, where it's like you have Gina Davis, who's she's attractive and she's smart, but she's not like, she's not like so attractive that she's not a real person. You know what I mean? She's out of his league, but like, you know, not ridiculously not so. You know, like, but that she's also like I said, a regular person too.
It's all believable.
Yes, exactly. You could see these two people getting together, and you could see like the idea of, I mean, the way they get together is just sort of like, okay, we're together now. Like, they just spontaneously have sex.
Sure.
But just because they need them to be together at a certain
point. But at the same time, like, Veronica's kind of motivated by, like, her ex-boyfriend being really obnoxious. And she's like, well, here's this sweet guy. I'm going to go for him instead. And I'm going to go all in. And that's why she, like, instantly moves in. Right. Like, she takes it five steps at a time because she's trying to get away from this other guy.
Well, all of it. Like, they're all motivated by terrible things. Like, she's motivated by hating her ex-boyfriend. Mm-hmm. He's motivated by jealousy and alcohol. And that's when he...
That's when he goes in the machine.
Goes in the machine and has this thing happen to him. Like, it's... He drinks and teleports. Hey, kids. P.S.
He's not driving. It's fine.
P.S.A. Don't drink and teleport. But
I love that so much more than if he had just done a test on himself and accidentally the fly was in there. Like, the fact that it's rooted in a bad decision. Motivated by something not pure, like jealousy.
Well, and it's one of those things that's also like, well, maybe this does feel like a real relationship because everything is motivated by, like, the wrong thing. And, like, how many people do you know in relationships for every single wrong reason, you know? But yeah, it's just another one of those kind of character gray areas that this movie puts them into. And I think that's great.
And then we have, you mentioned it earlier, the scene where he's slamming his hand on the table and he's adding so much sugar to his coffee.
Yeah.
I love
that he starts eating sugar, like, by the pound.
Yes. It's so, like, I don't know, it's unnerving. Like, this character that we've grown to kind of like... He's not acting right, and we know what happened to him, and we're watching, you can tell it's like, oh, this is the beginning.
But, I think that's the big benefit of having spent so much time before it happens, is you do get to know him, so when he starts acting weird before it's physical, you know, you can tell, like, oh, this, he's got a lot of energy.
Mentally, he's, like, changed. Yeah.
And he's just...
And then when he's in his bad boy state and he's going to bars.
He's going, like, to bars and eating candy bars, arm wrestling people.
As all badasses do, eating candy bars at a bar.
That's what they even say. They go, oh, careful, Marky. He eats chocolate bars. It's like, wait, is that like a... Is it manly to not eat candy bars? Is there like a weird... you know, bro code about that?
Oh, no. I think it's a little weird
at a bar. It is strange, yes.
He orders a glass of milk, like,
it's really weird. But I do like his ranting about, like, oh, you know, I'm the purest version of me.
I'm better, yeah.
And I feel great, and I'm clear. And his theory, I like his theory about, like, when they rebuild you, it's just your DNA and all, basically, like, all your toxins don't come with you. And you're just, like, the purest version of yourself.
It's a purifier somehow.
I'm like,
somehow.
That sounds really, really interesting. And it sounds like this guy who's a scientist is just, like, spitballing theories like he would be. Like, why do I feel so great now? Like,
right. And it's sort of... That's his explanation for what symptoms he's feeling.
Yeah. And I also like it because it is like that, and I'm not trying to throw shade because I've been a couple different versions of this person. The person who's newly sober, the person who gets you know, discovers a new, like, philosophy or writer or something, and they get very excited about it, and they want to tell everybody about it. And it's obnoxious, and it's annoying, and everybody around you is just like, okay, we get it. I'm not going to join your weird church or whatever. Right. You know, and it's that kind of energy that he's bringing to it. And Geena Davis, like, plays against it in, like, the best way, where she's trying to deal with it, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to understand him. And, you know, he just won't stop going on and on about it. And, yeah, that brings it to where he wants her to go through.
Right. It's his ego is consuming itself.
Right.
And just growing and growing. And it's all connected to this machine that he's proud of, that he built. And he's like, no, this is the greatest thing ever. It makes you more human. Everyone has to do this now.
Right.
And he's so forceful about it. And he won't listen to anyone who's like, you're not okay. Even when he's growing weird spikes out of his back. Like,
yeah, the no, real fine. Coarse hairs. But can I hear another one of the big themes? If I can bring this up now, and this is kind of a big one, it's kind of a heavy one, but it comes with these two parts. He arm wrestles, and the prize is the woman. And right. then, like, him trying to force Ronnie to go through the machine, and she's like, I don't want to, and he's being very forceful about it. And then later on, it's just blatantly out there where she wants to have an abortion when she finds out she's pregnant, and has a terrible nightmare that she's going to burn through a maggot, which is such a great scene.
Oh, that scene was chilling.
But there is a running theme in here about women's agency. The women having agency. Women being prizes. Women being forced to do things and things like that. And it's just such a... It's not preachy. It's not... it's not showing these things in a light that glamorizes that, oh, isn't it cool he won this woman in a bar? It's like, no, it's gross, and it's shown as
they
gross.
Point it out, yeah,
like everything, you see them together, and it's just gross, and it feels wrong. You feel how uncomfortable Geena Davis is when he's trying to, like, come on, you got to go through the machine, we'll be the dynamic duo, and he's mm-hmm. like, she's like, no, I don't want to, and then she's the scene with Cronenberg where she's like, I want to have an abortion, you know, at the midnight abortion clinic. And the two men in the room are like, are you really sure you want to have, you know, they're kind
of deciding,
trying to talk her out of it and things like that. And I just think it's a theme that is present, and it lets you see it for yourself that there's a running theme about women's agency in this movie.
It's really stood out to me. Yeah.
Because it's portrayed in those different scenarios. Even the idea of, like, not having control. Like, she comes home and her ex-boyfriend's in her apartment taking a shower. And he won't leave.
Right.
Like, she leaves her apartment. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have control in her own home. And it's just sort of like I feel like it's there for a reason. And I really appreciate that it was just portrayed and put on screen, and nobody gave a lecture about it.
I like how it was done, but it does leave me a little confused, because I feel like she is a passive character. Like, there's never a moment where she makes the choice for herself. It's the men fighting over her, even in the climax. The only thing she really does is she finally shoots the fly, but that's only like a mercy killing. Like,
she makes the choice to go see him. She does make the choice to go have an abortion, regardless of people trying to talk her out of it. I feel like she's a very active character. She chooses to leave her magazine and do the story anyway. She chooses to go with Seth. I feel like Veronica is a very empowered character. And I think that makes the theme even more important, is that even an empowered woman is having to fight for control. It doesn't come easily to her.
That's fair. She does make choices.
I think she makes a lot of choices, and she makes the choice to not go through. She doesn't just go along blindly with everything that she's presented.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my thought for a minute. But no, I think she's a very well-rounded, very grounded character, who has a lot of, depth and makes choices, but still has to fight her way through. Everybody in this movie is fighting their way through, honestly, but
that's all of it.
But
yeah.
In terms of that specific theme about agency, I think it's really well and smartly executed the way they show it.
I think that's fair. I'll probably have to like process it a little more. But yeah. You are right that she makes decisions.
But that's what I was saying. It's not super evident unless you're, you know, it didn't occur to me until she was legitimately going in and saying, I want to have an abortion. And I'm like, oh, this movie's all about agency. This movie's all about, you know, this keeps coming around. The woman in the bar really also stood out to me because it was just portrayed as so disgusting.
Yes.
Where, you know, he was like, oh, and I get to take her home for the night. And she goes, hey, wait a minute. And then she just goes along with him. Mm-hmm. Because he's terrifying. You know, everybody in that bar was terrifying. And yeah, the whole thing just felt disgusting.
And again, it's interesting that the sleazy guy is taking her to get an abortion, but not like, oh, it's some other man's child, or, oh, we need to get rid of this. It's like, I'm going to support you in this, whatever you want to do.
It was,
and of course, Brendel Fly, driven by his...
Very pro-life.
He's a Texas senator now.
He's out there protesting on the streets, smashing into the clinic and stealing women away. So
your baby
won't...
has fingernails. He's so obsessed with
it. Oh my God, Juno would have been so much better if Brundle Fly was in it.
They bring up Cronenberg in that movie. Okay, so I want to talk about Brendel Fly's transformation.
Yes, because, please.
It was so fascinating, like his slow progression. He starts out like, oh, this is amazing. I feel so great. Then he won't listen to reason when everyone's like, hey, you're not acting like yourself. Because he's in denial. He doesn't want to face reality. Mm-hmm. And then finally, he's like, my fingernails are falling out. I think I might be dying. And then he eventually hides. He goes to people. He asks for help. He's like, you're right. I had this disease. And then finally, the last true time we see Brendel is when she goes to visit him and he tells her to go away. And that scene, I love it so much. Like, I need to go rewatch it because when he's talking about like flies can't be politicians and she's like, I don't know what you're saying. And he's like,
right.
I'm telling you to go because I'm not a person anymore.
Right.
I'm an insect that dreamed he was a person. And like, that's so chilling to me. There's like, it's so psychologically horrifying.
There's a, there's a weird thing that runs when he starts losing his fingernails, and then the next time you see him lose like a tooth or so, I think it's a tooth.
Yeah, he loses a tooth.
And he opens up his medicine cabinet and has all the body parts that have fallen off of him he has like saved.
He calls it the museum of Brendel.
Yes, and it is like an homage to like his lost humanity at that point. But there's a real kind of interesting thing if you look at this in terms of like kind of like enlightenment gone wrong, where it is like the idea of like the collective consciousness, you know, like you lose your ego and you become part of this bigger thing, like we're all a collective, right? Like this big sort of Taoist and Buddhist idea that we're all one.
Yeah,
you know, and that's him and the fly, they are one. And for a minute, they're in balance. And then it sort of goes way off the deep end. The way he, like, is philosophical about it and constantly, like, talking about is it is this it's the same kind of thing of like, oh, here's a Buddhist idea, but the whole thing is like, what if this idea of enlightenment went horribly, horribly wrong? Like that's the crux of the movie. Like this is the same thing we saw in like Fight Club. Mm-hmm. Like Fight Club is about like transcending the material world, but then like they become terrorists, you know? And right now I'm reading American Psycho, and the movie is great, but I'm reading the book for the first time. And like the book, you get so much more depth because it is like, it's about these millionaires, these yuppie millionaires in the 80s who have like, the idea of like shedding the ego is like shedding your identity, sort of like this Buddhist idea of like losing your ego, transcending your ego. And, but like these guys have like, they have no ego or they have no personality. They have no decision-making process. They're all ego. They don't care about anything. They don't have passion for anything. They've sort of like lost their individuality, but in a bad way. And it's like the whole idea of it is like the psycho part of it is the outlet. It gets so out of, you know, like people are mistaking, they don't know who each other are. They're like always mistaking each other for somebody else because they're all the same person basically, but in like the worst, most shallow, most lifeless way possible. It's a weird, really, really interesting and really hilarious but the movie's
American Psycho.
Watch the movie with Christian Bale. It's really, really funny. In a really dark and twisted way.
But it was a horror movie.
It is, but it's also, like, his performance is amazing. It's so funny. But then the book really gets into, like, all the monologuing in the movie. That's what the, like, entire book is. Like, they don't talk about a person. They're like, he was wearing an Armani suit with gray pinstripes. And, you know, like, everything is about...
That's how he identifies the people.
Where they bought... What are they wearing? Where did they buy it from? You know, in... You know, we look down on this person wearing cotton socks. And, you know, like, this other... It's just... It's so ridiculous that it's hilarious. And it is about, like, the Buddhist idea of, like, shedding your ego. But, like, in the worst way possible. Like, it's gone so horribly wrong.
Right.
And that's what this movie is. This movie is about a collective consciousness gone horribly, horribly wrong. And I love these kind of ideas that are taking this kind of like Eastern concepts and they go, okay, but what if it went really sideways or really in the wrong direction? And like, that's kind of what this is too.
I don't know if... I want to disagree with you because I think you're bringing that to the table.
I 100% I am.
I don't think that's the intention.
I don't think it was the intention either, but I think it's something I parallel to like Fight Club and American Psycho.
But I do think that Brendel, I think he thinks he's transcended. I think he thinks he's doing this, but he isn't. And that's the issue. Like,
no,
and his ego has gone so far. He's, I'm this new thing. I'm this brand new thing.
That's the issue in Fight Club and American Psycho, too. It's that they think they're a level above, but they're not. They've done it all wrong. They brought all the wrong shit to it. Like, that's what Brundlefly ends up being.
They're feeding their ego, but they think that...
they think they've transcended it.
Yes. And it's so weird to me, but I love that, like, he has that moment of clarity at the end and he's like, you need to go because if you don't, I'm going to hurt you.
Right. He's not in control anymore. That's like the last bit of Brendel is there.
The last bit is telling her to leave before he does something he doesn't want to. And then of course he finds out that, oh, she's pregnant. And at that point, he's not in control, and the monster goes after her.
It's such a wild ride, that last bit, where from the time he, like, smashes into the hospital, the kidnapper, to the end is, like, that plan of, like, you and me, we go through the thing together, and we become, like, one person. and like the ultimate family, he says. You know, like it is, it is this just so bizarre and twisted, but in a, not in a way that makes sense, but in a way that it seems like, yes, this would make sense to him.
To him, yeah.
To him, he, who thinks he's still got that, I'm, we're, we'll be higher than humanity, and we'll be together, and this is what a family, not, it's no longer like, I'm a step above. Now it's, my family is transcended, like we're the ultimate family.
Four in one,
right?
Or three in one, or whatever.
Plus the fly,
yeah. Right. Plus the fly.
It's
a really weird mix. He's got the fly DNA again, the fly DNA in the child,
yep,
and the two humans. It's it's a weird combination.
It is a weird combination,
and I love this scene right before that where he's trying to figure out this problem, and he turns on the computer. And the voice activation doesn't recognize him.
Oh, when he's too much the fly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that point, oh.
And he has to type with his like two-fingered hands, or you know, like the giant mega fingers he has.
Right.
It's it's pretty wild. But I like that it's even the thing that doesn't have actual intelligence or life won't recognize you as a person anymore. You know, like, because you're not, or not, it's not that it won't recognize you as a person, won't recognize you as you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because your voice has changed too much.
His own life's work is like, I don't know you.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not going to let you in. I don't know you.
Yeah. It's really interesting. It's an interesting story about lost humanity, and
it's really sad.
It is a tragedy.
Unbelievably sad at the end of this movie.
This is not like a horror movie where the monster is haunting and chasing and trying to kill the final girl. I guess Veronica's a final girl, even though she's kind of the only girl.
The only one.
I mean, there's only like four people in this movie anyway.
Hey, the woman he picks up at the bar survives, okay?
Oh, that's true. But where usually it's like, oh, Freddy Krueger got killed. Yay, victory, the bad guy. You know, when he dies, it is like, it not only feels tragic, but it's portrayed as tragic.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
I think in some way, Brendel is the final girl, except he doesn't make it to the end. But he's the true victim that we're focusing on, and he's being chased by the monster, which again is his ego and his inability to see that he's
his animal impulses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His insect impulses.
Do you think there was any of the worst tendencies already in Brundel? We didn't really see them.
I mean,
I think that would have been interesting. Sort of a Walter White scenario.
Well, he still has that ego at the very beginning. He thinks he's created the greatest thing ever.
Right.
But he's not going to show you, because then you're going to announce it and steal your...
Steal my idea.
Yeah. So, like, it's all there in the beginning. I feel like the fly just amplified it. Yeah. Or, like, kept him in that state where he was drunk and jealous and
not caring. Yeah, it was in that, yeah.
But he did have some heart. He had some humanity.
Oh, I think he was not a dick. That's not what I'm saying, but it's just sort of like, was there a little bit of the... Because I think the ego is, you know, when he first gets it and he's doing gymnastics on the chair and in the coffee shop, like, hitting the table. It's like, I feel like that was him just... heightened a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's still...
And he doesn't know what to do.
Kind of insufferable. And it's just like trying to spout it all out.
Very insufferable.
Yeah. Here's a weird thing I caught. At some point, the Nobel Prize gets brought up. Because this is a movie about science. So we have to bring up the Nobel Prize.
Of course.
Every movie, I swear to God... science is only motivated by the possibility of winning a Nobel Prize.
Yep.
And I'm not a scientist, but is that truly the only thing that motivates science and technology and progress in that field, is the possibility of winning a Nobel Prize?
That's right, Dad. That's the only thing scientists ever...
It's all that and funding.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
No, nothing else.
We're not driven to just, like, discover things or, you know...
I was going to be an athlete, and then I heard they're just giving out these medals. They Nobel don't even prizes. Mean anything.
Yeah, wow.
So you go into science, and if you earn a Nobel Prize, that's rare. That's how you've achieved it.
That's it. It just really stood out to me. I'm like, geez, every movie I feel like it's like, ooh, a Nobel Prize. It's like, yeah. I get it.
I've never worked in a lab with, like, real scientists, but I have science major friends, and I don't think that, like...
Yeah.
I don't think that's what motivates... I think it's a very superficial reason that, like, movie people kind of just put in there as, like, what's this character's goal? Well, he likes science, so he wants a Nobel Prize.
It would be like suggesting that every actor is only an actor because they think they might win an Oscar one day. Like, the Oscar is the only thing motivating their entire life choices of pursuing acting.
I mean, I think that a little bit. I mean...
I think, okay, like...
Of course, they want to make good art, they want to have a career, but, like, I do think that's a highly motivational thing.
I think it's something everybody Hollywood. Is kind of like, well, it would be nice to win an Oscar, but, like,
right.
You know, I mean, that's
I don't think that's their only goal.
Yeah, like, I mean, I make comics, and I don't make them because I think I'll win an Eisner one day, like,
right.
But, I mean, it would be cool, but an award can't be someone's only motivation for doing something.
That's true. It is for some people, but it's very shallow.
It's a very weird goal. Yeah. You know, when we win a podcast award, this will finally all be worth it.
Oh, we'll have to cut this part out.
And we pay for our own trophy. That'll be finally. We will have made
it. That's the only thing we're doing this for, guys.
That's right.
So make sure to vote.
Anyway.
I also wanted to talk about the gore and, like, just the effects in this movie, because... This is my first Cronenberg movie.
Yeah?
I think so. Is The Thing Cronenberg?
No,
I
don't think that's, so. That's John Carpenter.
John Carpenter, right.
John Carpenter's The Thing is
what?
A John
he
Carpenter
did that?
Film. Yes.
I just thought he named it that. Yeah. No, but...
What an odd choice.
I do think this is the first Cronenberg movie I've seen. And I've heard a lot about, like...
Very famous for, like, body horror.
Right. And buckets of blood like and stuff. And, yeah. But, like...
It's just gross out kind of stuff.
It is. And I found myself, like, when he's picking at his fingernails mm-hmm. or, like, teeth are falling out, the ear, I'm like, ugh. But I can't look away. I want to watch.
It's very... I typically don't like body horror. Mm-hmm. And for as much credit as, like, Cronenberg gets for, like, body horror, I feel like they do way grosser things in movies now. Like, body horror now is just, like, extreme.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just disfigurement and stuff like that. I feel like Cronenberg stuff is, like, it's more, like, what this movie is. It's more monstrous. It's, like, it's not just the throwing up acid thing. Mm-hmm. It's the way his face looked, like it had like runaway acne and it got progressively worse until, and just sort of like the slowly turning into a monster and what his skin looked like. It wasn't necessarily blood and body fluid and weird broken bones and disfigurement that way. It was more of just sort of like, can you imagine if your face looked like Jeff Goldblum, like halfway through this movie, just like a wasting disease and on top of like some weird pox that you got,
mm-hmm.
And just slowly turning into something else. Like it's that kind of almost existential body horror that I think this was.
It's over the top, like, not tremendously, but it is kind of a little unrealistic, and that's why I think I can bear it, because there are, like, nowadays movies too realistic. Like, I know, yeah. I know what you're showing me is fake, but, like, I don't want to see it. Like,
In
Smile, there's some pretty gross body horror.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that looks like a real person just did that. And I don't want to see that. Whereas this is, like, a little stretched out from reality. And I'm like...
It fits the story that's being told and the genre. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, yes, it's not real, but it's still gross. And mm-hmm. I'll use an example of the Cenobites in Hellraiser, like the original Hellraiser. I saw for the first time just a few months ago. And the way those monsters look, they have like hooks in their face and like pulling at the, it's this very thing where you just like, you look at it and you can kind of feel that in your own neck.
In yourself,
and
yeah.
that is the kind of thing that skeeves me out and is way like more like visceral, or you can kind of feel it. Another example, like 127 Hours, the movie, the James Franco movie where he, mm-hmm. he gets trapped. The point where, spoiler alert, where he cuts his own arm off. I couldn't watch. I couldn't look at the screen. I just sat there and I held my arms.
Your intact arms.
I just waited for it to be over. And it's a really solid movie. I didn't hate the movie, but I could not watch that
That's
part.
That's tough. It is.
And there are things that I have a really hard time watching like that, where I can feel it happening to myself. This wasn't the case with this, but it just was, I think, so artistically done as well. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's just creative. The makeup work on him, this practical effects, you know what I mean? Like,
it's a work of art. Like, yes. I don't want to call it beautiful, but in a sense, it is. It's like...
It totally is.
It's well made. It does what it's meant to.
You can call it a work of art, because I think...
No, it's a work of art.
Like Rob Bottin and Rick Baker, these big-time famous makeup, you know, monster makeup people. I mean, they're making artwork. The movies they make it in, it may be schlock. It may be genre stuff that's written off as not great art. But the things they're making are incredible.
No, practical effects are 100% art. But even something like gross like this is art. And I love, like, I feel like if this was in a different movie where it was just like, we're going to show, you know, chins falling off just for the sake of it.
Leprosy, the movie.
Right. Like, that's a little boring. But when it's like ingrained in this story of losing your humanity, and he's like, when his ear falls off,
yes.
and you see the horror on his face.
That's what it is when we see his collection of stuff in the medicine cabinet.
Yeah, he has his
ear comes off.
Well, no, his ear comes off when he's hugging her. His teeth.
Oh, okay.
His teeth fall off, and that's when he puts them next to the ear in the medicine.
It's so gross.
In the Museum of Brundle. Yeah. Yes. Which I hope that's a real thing in LA somewhere.
It's just a medicine cabinet. And
that's it.
You have to travel. You have to find that warehouse.
Yep.
And go to it.
Some movie studio has that somewhere.
That would be great.
But when it's tied to like that human story, that's when it's really creepy.
For sure. And I also like that it is a slow transformation. You know what I mean? Like, we watch him slowly devolve into that. It isn't like, it's not an American Werewolf in London, though that is a amazing transformation scene where it takes place in a 2 minute sequence where he morphs into the fly immediately. You know, like, this is over weeks and months that he's slowly devolving. And I just love that every time we come back to him after we follow Ronnie around for a little while.
It's like, what's going to be new?
And, you know, he's climbing the walls at some point. Like, oh, check it out. Look at me. And it's just like, oh, my God.
And her expressions. Yes. Her reactions to it she are always us, the best. She is
like having a reaction to what he looks like now.
The scene where he asks her to film for the documentary, him eating.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, it's super gross. But it's Chekhov's vomit because we have to know
revisit that.
What he's doing so that when he burns her boyfriend's hand off with his puke, oh my God.
Ugh.
What a disgusting scene, but what a actual, like, kind of brilliant monster movie device to use.
It's, you know, Chekhov's vomit. If you're going to show vomit in Act 1, you have to show him eating someone's flesh in Act 3.
Act 3.
You just have to.
I mean, it's basic screenwriting. I'm trying to... our internet is down. We're still dealing with the after effects of Hurricane Ian, and that is spotty internet service. I'm trying to look up who did the fly effects for this movie.
Oh, because they did say because, in the credits.
Because that is who directs The Fly 2, which I have not seen, but I think I might actually check that out.
I found it interesting that there's 5 Fly movies.
Wait, what?
Well, they made the first one in 1958 whatever, and then they made 2 sequels to that.
Did they really?
They did. The Fly Returns, and there's one other one. And
Son
then,
of the Fly?
Bride
of the Fly.
But maybe.
Abbott and Costello Meet the Fly.
But that's basically what The Fly 2 is. They made a sequel to this movie.
Yes.
About her having the baby.
Apparently she had the baby.
It was so weird after the whole plot of this was like her getting an abortion.
Well, it's just like the original like Roe versus Wade case that took so long that baby was born.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. So after she had the baby, she was granted the right to have an abortion.
She's like, great.
Thanks. But actually a great victory. Even though it's being walked back. Watch this movie. It's very pro-choice.
This is a good movie.
This movie
has a good message.
It has the message. Pro-choice is important. That's right. But no, I do find that interesting that the effects director directed The Fly 2. And I was telling you, it's like again, I can't look it up right now, and I don't know the name. The director of those John Wick movies was like the stunt coordinator for, I think, The Matrix. Mm-hmm. So he and Keanu Reeves had worked together, and he wanted to direct a movie that was really focused on fight choreography and stunts. And that's why
he did.
Those John Wick movies are what they are and are very successful because they set out to be exactly what they wanted them to be.
It's pretty cool, though.
I think it's great. And the Mission Impossible movies are a lot of fun. And those are basically just built around what set pieces can we have to do stunts, to do these big, like, Tom Cruise stunts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, like, the idea of taking, like, people who've worked in other areas in movies and them stepping up and directing and making a film that is
being in charge
that is sort of, like, focused on this area of expertise of theirs. I just watched a video about the Pumpkinhead series, a sort of cult horror series. But the original one was directed by Rick Baker. I had no idea. I had heard of Pumpkinhead. I've never seen it. Directed by Rick Baker, who's like a famous movie makeup guy and creature effects.
Oh, and so he made this thing that focused on that.
I'm sorry, not Rick Baker. Stan Winston.
See, I don't know either of these names.
Stan Winston did a lot of the Jurassic Park dinosaurs builds a lot of monsters and creatures and things like that. But yeah, directed this Pumpkinhead movie. It was just a little cult hit. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, very. Anyway, you got anything else on the fly?
No, except for if you haven't seen this, you should.
I highly recommend this movie. I had a blast with this.
It was really fun.
I knew this was a good movie, but it's one of those where I'm like, I need to revisit this more. This movie is really, really fun.
Three of my notes to start off with were, oh my god.
Yes, I saw that.
Because how else do I describe this movie? It was that insane.
I think this movie is great from, what year is this? 86? 88? Something like that. It's way back. It's got a couple 80s references that really jumped out at me that kind of date the movie. It is very much in its time. But, man, I think this is kind of a cult movie in that it's not a movie a lot of people talk about or reference or... I would imagine a lot of people your age haven't seen or maybe even heard of, but I think it's totally worth revisiting if you've seen it or if you haven't, give it a look. It's it's really cool.
Not a lot of people talk about this movie, but the reason I actually wanted to watch it was because the clip of him climbing the walls the first time he does it. I did see that on TikTok.
Oh, really?
And a bunch of people commenting, oh, this is such an underrated movie. This is so good. One of my favorites.
Well, maybe it's still got a strong audience, like a cult audience for
it. Yeah, it's not like big in pop culture. Yeah.
But it's one of those that you kind of look at it and you go, it should be, right? Like, it's just one of those that you kind of think, I'm trying to think of an example of something like The Thing that... took a little while, but eventually found an audience, and then like a younger audience found, like, that's a movie that kind of is getting handed down to younger people, and like is probably more popular than it ever was right now. And
it's because it's one of those like this that messes with your mind. Like, this movie is such a just ruins your mind pretty much. It's like, oh my gosh, no, not Brendel. Like,
and I think it is the practical effects help it, because that's very unique. You don't get those anymore. And
no, you don't.
And they do look different, and I think a lot of times a lot better. And I think it's just lost my mind again. I think there is something to it. Is a movie that isn't made, like, that movie's not going to be made again.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, this, at some point, somebody will reboot the Fly franchise, and it will be probably terrible. You know, like, this will be the better version of it still.
He'll come out of the pod after merging with the Fly and be like, well, that just happened.
Right? Like, it'll be quippy and just
pause for the laughter.
Terrible.
I think Robert Downey Jr. is set to play him.
Probably, yeah. Actually, if you want to see a Fly remake, there is a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror where Bart goes through a teleportation machine with a fly and becomes a fly. It's Bart with a fly head.
Nice.
Yeah, check it out.
I do think I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, really good.
Also, The Fly, the episode of Breaking Bad, directed by
Rian Johnson. Yes.
It's also a good Fly movie.
Rian Johnson has a few great Breaking Bad episodes.
It's true.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's The Fly. Highly recommend. Thank you for bringing that to the show.
Thanks for watching.
I'm really stoked to have watched it again.
It's a nice one.
I think one of the better things we've watched this season.
I think that's pretty fair.
Sneak preview for our recap episode, but this is really in the running. I really had a blast with this.
I did too.
So, cool. We ready for shout-outs?
I am.
All right. You want me to go first?
Yeah. What do you got for us?
I have a new podcast. This has just started coming out in the last week, and it's called This Farm Girl Cooks Podcast. This is my cousin Deanne. She has had her website, blog, she does videos, and a social media presence for several years now, and it's based around her cooking for her family. She is, I want to call her a farmer's wife, but it just sounds reductive. They are a farm family, and, and a lot of it deals with, you know, keeping weird hours. And she talks about, like, here's how I make meals to take to my husband when he's working in the field. Here's how I cook for my kids, and here's how it gets around our lifestyle of school, farm is a small business that you are working at all the time.
Yeah.
And it is just, it's a food show, and her whole brand is food, but it is geared towards that specific lifestyle. But it's also very open to anybody who's busy, anybody who's raising kids, anybody who needs easy, good meals that are not fast food to feed their family. Here's how to, you know, it's a crock pot meal. Here's a meal you can freeze and take out. And her podcast is breaking that down with some episodes just about different topics around how to feed your family. So
nice.
I'm really happy that Deanne has gotten into the podcast space with us and is bringing her talent for cooking into this format. I think it's really cool and really exciting. And if you are into food, into cooking, check it out. It's a different angle on it. So, or if you're into farming and need some ideas for how to eat better.
That's awesome. Yeah. Did you know you're bringing that up on a, I believe today is Farmer Appreciation
Day. Farmer Appreciation Day as we're recording this. That's correct. Deanna and I are from the same small town, and we grew up in a rural area. Yes, it was very much part of our culture, you know, where we grew up. And she still lives in that area and is, you know, very active in that culture.
It's something I don't think about a lot, but it's like, we really should appreciate where our food comes from.
I did notice that when I didn't live on a farm anymore, is that, like, people really don't know where their food comes from. And it's, I think it's getting better with things like farmers markets being more available, fresh produce being more available in more places.
Yeah.
And people gardening at home. Sort of, you at least get a little taste of, like, hey, it takes work to raise, you know, like, this is a,
you spend all gear in the garden and you get, like, enough for a salad and maybe some more. Like, you can't sustain yourself off just a little backyard farm.
Imagine
you get a taste of it.
Imagine the work that goes into 1,000 acres of this, and things like that. It's just getting off the ground, and I'm really happy for her. So please go check out her podcast wherever you download and listen to podcasts. I'm sorry, my brain's not working tonight. And I will have a link to her host site in the show notes. Check it out.
Sure.
What do you got, Oz?
I wanted to shout out a kind of lesser known HBO show. I mean, it's an HBO show, so it's not like, oh, they're really
between HBO viewers. I'll be honestly. No, they don't hurt for anything that is still being produced. But HBO, between them and, like, HBO Max and the 800 other shows on that app, there's a lot of stuff that I think is great that a lot of people, like, nobody's watching it.
Right. And it's like you're competing with other shows on the network at that point. But I really wanted to shout out, this is Avenue 5, which is a hilarious comedy. Starring Hugh Laurie and a few others. It's a big ensemble cast. The guy who plays Olaf in Frozen is in it. Josh.
The snowman?
Yeah. Josh something or other. I don't know. He plays a rich billionaire.
Is that Josh Gad?
Yeah, Josh Gad. That's Olaf is my reference for him always.
Really? I've never seen that movie, so I don't.
He's done a lot more. I shouldn't just reduce him to one role. But regardless, the show's written by the same guy who did Veep. He did The Thick of It. He's done a lot of other comedies, and it's insanely funny. It's about a, you know, rich cruise liner that accidentally gets knocked off course, and trapped in space, and the captain of said ship, Hugh Laurie, is not a real captain. He's a British actor who was hired to play an American captain and make everyone feel calmer
okay.
on the show. He mixes up his accent all the time. It's really funny. Give the show a chance because it is one of the best shows.
I've heard good things. I'm guilty of not watching it as well, but you know.
They just came back for season two, and due to COVID, basically all of their contracts were up, and so it's kind of up in the air.
Mm.
But they're really fighting for a renewal because they have like a long plan for the show. I see
an Arrested Development season four situation
Please
coming in.
No. I mean, they're airing stuff that they like just filmed after COVID, and it's still keeping in line with what season one was. So it's a really great show, and everyone should watch it.
By the way, Josh Gad ended up starring in Swim Instructors on Barry. The movie he was going to do ended up being Josh Gad, I think. And someone else was in it. I don't remember.
It's like Swim Instructors. I don't think I've seen that one, Dad. It's made up for Barry. That's a good one.
Another great HBO show. On that note, I want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. And another way to help us grow the show is to tell people about us. So if you have friends, and that's a rather big assumption, tell them about us. If those friends are merged with insects, go ahead and have them fly around the neighborhood.
Yeah, we can still download a podcast.
Yeah. Hey, here's a better movie related thing. Go ahead and teleport your way into your friend's house and tell them to listen to our show.
All my teleportation devices have built in MP3 players, and Wi-Fi, so you can download a podcast. And you can listen to it on your teleportation.
Without getting motion sickness.
That's the big motivation for doing it in the first place.
You know, I hear some doctors, 9 out of 10 doctors agree that listening to The Picture Show will reduce motion sickness. Don't quote me on that.
And no, I think that's 100% true. And the 10th doctor is not in your insurance network, so don't even worry about it.
Yeah, don't listen to what that guy says.
All right.
What's next week?
Next week, we are watching the space horror movie Pandorum.
Pandorum!
I have seen this movie a long time ago, probably when it first came out. All I remember is it stars Dennis Quaid and Ben Foster. Ben Foster's awesome. And a shitload of weird space zombies or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's this called? Pandorum?
Pandorum.
Yes. I don't think I've heard of this one.
It was kind of a smaller movie.
It's a recent old?
Maybe 10 or 15 years old. It's not new. I probably rented it from Blockbuster in the last days of Blockbuster Video.
That's a good way to figure out how old a movie is.
I remember having late charges on that movie. No, but yeah, I'm looking forward to revisiting this.
Cool.
So
I'm looking forward to more space movies. Space horror.
I remember liking it a lot, and I hope I still do.
All right.
So
looking forward to it.
Cool. Us. What's your social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Austin N. Rude or Old Who Review.
All right.
Where can people find you?
I'm at Phil Rood on Twitter, at PhilRood75 on Instagram, and ko-fi.com/PhilRood. You can support me. You can buy me a cup of coffee. You can buy yourself a book or a download. Or you can just see the things I post there. I don't put it behind a paywall, so you can just come hang out.
Cool.
Oh, so you want to read the credits?
Yeah. We did it all ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya. Bzz, 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 bzz.